I would describe it as constant discomfort at best and constant pain at worst.
It's like a constant burning, tingling sensation.
It's always needing to go for a wee.
I don't know if it was a UTI, that's a thing.
When you do go for a wee, it's severe burning.
Like, I just had to pee a lot, all the time.
It kind of feels like someone's shoving a knife up your vagina.
You can't get comfortable in any position and it keeps you awake.
And then you sit down on the toilet and nothing comes out. And then you get up and you feel like you need to wee again.
And I also get like pain in my lower abdomen.
And it's the kind of constant groundhog day of like pure hell.
Once I ignored it and it spread to my kidneys.
So all you can do is lie motionless with heat pack on your back and take lots of painkillers.
Many of you will know firsthand exactly what having a urinary tract infection, also known as a UTI, feels like. After all, around half of all women in the UK will suffer at least one UTI at some point in their lives. The symptoms can leave you bedbound and be extremely disrupting to your life. But for others, you might be able to go about your day in mild discomfort. Whatever the symptoms, for the majority of women, and it is mainly women who suffer, it's thankfully a short-lived experience. But what if those symptoms didn't go away?
It started to get really scary. It was sort of like, I'm in pain constantly.
Week after week.
I went back numerous times. I said, I don't feel right. This is not right. Please, can I have some more antibiotics?
Month after month. Year after year. You see, this series isn't about UTIs. Not exactly. It's about chronic UTIs. Or QT.
That's what everyone calls it. I just hate that it's got the word Q in it, but I would probably refer to it as QT.
And unlike short-term or acute UTIs, these didn't officially exist until very recently.
So I said I have a chronic UTI, an embedded UTI infection, and he was just so stumped, was like, that's not real.
I'm Verity DiCarla, podcast producer, and in this episode of QT, we're looking at the stories of patients at the first stages of the illness. We'll find out how misconceptions, misogyny, and a lack of research have not only shaped the science, but also the patient's experiences, making it almost impossible to get a diagnosis. Episode 1. Tests, misogyny, and misconceptions.
I listen, you're the professional.
Am I? I'm not around you.
This is Anna.
We're in a cupboard.
If you say we have to go in a cupboard, we have to go in a cupboard. And I accept that.
Who I've put in a cupboard because that was the only way the audio would sound remotely professional.
Intimate isn't even the word. This is like, beyond intimate.
I wanted to begin with Anna's story because she's the reason I know anything about QT. And about 4 years ago, when we lived together, she got a UTI that just didn't go away.
I slept with a guy one time, got a UTI, first time I've ever had a UTI. Went to the doctors and it kind of went away, but I still had lingering feelings of sort of urethral burning and stuff like that. And I remember going back and they tested my urine and they were like, you're clear, you're fine, there's nothing wrong. And then basically maybe 70% of the time after that that I slept with somebody, I would get a UTI. So I remember one time I went on a run and then I got a UTI and I was like, that's really weird. Went to the doctor, they tested me, they were like, you don't have a UTI. But I'm thinking, you know, I'm having these symptoms, I'm staying up, I'm having to drink so much water, it really hurts when I pee, all classic UTI symptoms. And it got to the point that I was living in consistent pain, was crying to the NHS being like, please, can you help me? Like I'd been to A&E at that point. And again, just all of these different health professionals were just telling me there's nothing wrong. It's not coming up on the tests. Have an ibuprofen. But that was kind of how it went for maybe a year, to the point that I was in pain all the time.
The cycle of waiting for a GP appointment, getting a short dose of antibiotics, or getting no medication at all is something everyone with QT has gone through, no matter their age or circumstance.
So I'm Caroline Sampson. I'm 60 years old. I live in Bushey in Hertfordshire. In March 2016, I was sent to a specialist menopause GP because I was on estrogen patches but couldn't tolerate the progesterone. And she told me I would need a Myrina coil fitted to pump out progesterone.
Progesterone is a hormone that is often used to treat symptoms of menopause. High numbers of peri and menopausal women suffer from QT, and we'll get into why later. But after Caroline had her coil removed, her pain persisted and she was having increasingly difficult encounters with doctors the more she went back.
And I was becoming really anxious by this stage, thinking, what's going on here? You know, I know I'm not right, but I'm being told by these results that all is well. So in the August of that year, I asked to go and see a urologist, which I did. And he said to me, look, these results have all come back negative. You don't have a UTI. You haven't had one since March. I suggest you go and get psychiatric help. That's what he said to me.
When confronted with women in pain, the suggestion of emotional instability as the cause is always lurking just around the corner. From being told you're stressed to being told to see a therapist, this is a theme that comes up even more frequently for QT patients off the back of these negative test results.
The narrative changes very quickly from you have an organic disease, like, you know, you've got a UTI or you've got bladder pain syndrome, whatever, to you have a psychological problem. That flips really quickly from I don't know what's wrong with you, therefore it must be something psychological. And that's just what patients are telling me.
I think in that year before I had a diagnosis, I probably did speak to at least 20 different doctors, nurses and emergency room professionals, whatever the word is. And no one at any point was like, right, this is bad that it's happening to you and I'm going to follow up and I'm going to look into it. I just don't understand how they couldn't have at least found out about the concept of a chronic urinary tract infection.
This is a question QT sufferers are constantly left asking. Why wasn't the information there for doctors? And why was the desire to look further stifled again and again? I mentioned previously that the term chronic UTI was not added to the NHS guidelines until very recently. In March 2022, to be exact. I wanted to find out why these tests were coming back negative and how long the information had been out there.
My name is Raj Kasria. I'm a consultant urogynecologist. I work at the Whittington Hospital. I'm the lead for the chronic UTI clinic or LUTS clinic at the Whittington.
Back in 2008, Dr. Raj started a PhD with the late Professor James Malone Lee. He was a pioneer in the field and sadly passed away in 2022. What the professor, Dr. Raj, and the team of researchers found completely broke with assumptions that had been made about UTIs for the last 70 years.
One of the first things I did when I started my research was to listen to these patients and think, okay, they keep on telling us they've got an infection. The tests don't always pick it up. Okay, well why would that be?
If you've been to the doctor with a UTI, you'll know that often the first thing they do is a dipstick test. Then, depending on the result of that test, you might have a second, called a midstream urine culture, or MSU.
When you compare the dipstick, which is this little strip that you put in wee, actually, when you compare it to the urine culture, it's actually not very good. It's not good at picking up an infection. But the problem is that that's the first thing that happens when you go to any doctor. And if it's got some signs in it of an infection, then you might get treated or that urine might be sent off to a laboratory for further testing. So what patients were facing was that this dipstick would be negative. And so people would say, well, you haven't got an infection. We don't care what symptoms you've got. The dipstick says no. And then we looked at urine culture and we realised something. astounding again. And that's about our own prejudices and about our own bias. So we trust tests a lot. And once we started to look at this test and even test healthy volunteers, we realised that there's a lot of flaws in the urine culture. And it starts with how that sample is taken and how long it even takes to get to a lab.
It can take days for urine to get to a lab, and they realise that during this time, in certain conditions, the bacteria causing a UTI simply won't survive and therefore won't be detected. And once they started digging, they realised the problems with urine cultures were more historic than previously thought. In 1957, the scientist Edward Cass gathered urine samples from a small group of pregnant women who had severe kidney infection. His work was never representative of women with UTIs, yet it's this research that has set the threshold for urine culture tests for the last 60 years. Their research showed that the dipstick tests miss 60% of chronic and recurring infection, while the urine cultures miss a staggering 90%. In 2015, some guidelines did change, stating that women can get antibiotics without a test if showing two signs of a UTI. But very often, the test is still relied on. As with many women's health issues, it seems the research was never properly done in the first place.
We also then realised that healthy people also have bacteria in their urine. And it was actually became really difficult to understand the difference between healthy people and people with an infection if you just look at a urine culture, because everybody's got bacteria there. So just the presence of bacteria in your urine can't prove that you've got an infection. It can prove that that bacteria is there, but we don't know what it's doing. It could be in the background doing nothing. And so we began to understand that and unpick some of the problems of why we are not successfully treating people with these bladder symptoms.
So I went to the female doctor and she was like quite nice. She just gave me a 3-day course of antibiotics and basically said, this is the usual protocol, drink cranberry juice, wipe after sex, bloody bloody blah, wee after sex, all of the usual things which to now to me have become like problematic stereotypes.
The language and the myths surrounding UTI shed light on the reasons why all this science and all this research hasn't trickled down into the medical sphere.
You're told, you know, you get your first UTI from having sex, and you get it because you don't go to the toilet properly after sex, or the other one, which is really horrible, is a hygiene thing. So like, there's this idea that like you're more prone to UTIs if you're not hygienic and you don't clean down there properly and things like that, which is wild because the vagina and bladder area are self-cleaning anyway, so it can't really be, it's bacteria that comes from other things. And obviously sex can be a trigger, but it's not the cause.
The language and the myths surrounding this disease create the idea that this is something women can prevent, that UTIs aren't that serious, and if you get them, it's in some way your fault.
There's definitely a lot of guilt attached to it all. And I think that is also massively like related to the perceptions of it. And I think probably because of how I was treated by medical professionals, it was kind of like, it's put on you. It is like this, you made to feel like it's kind of your fault you have this. So that then embeds itself, that thought embeds itself within you, and you very much internalise this idea of like, this is kind of my fault, and like, I'm slowly working out that it isn't, but there's layers to it on that level as well.
The perfect example of these persistent attitudes cropped up recently in an article by documentary maker and women's health campaigner Kate Muir. It perfectly demonstrated how science is continually being ignored while more pressure is put on women to change their behaviours. She pointed out a recent NHS press release that aimed to raise awareness on how to prevent UTIs in the older population. Here she is talking about the press release on Women's Hour.
And then this NHS press release came out in the autumn and it said, we must stop these UTIs. It had three big experts, including a gerontologist, on the press release. And women must clean themselves better and drink more water. And we must be on the lookout for this. And I thought, wait, a minute, what is missing here? Vaginal oestrogen.
UTI rates go up drastically when women hit 45 and are perimenopausal. And we know now that this is because of the loss of the hormone oestrogen. This press release from last October advised women to wash themselves more, stay hydrated, but failed to mention vaginal oestrogen at all.
When you want to study something as a scientist, you need to get funding. And the way you get funding is you write grants. And when you write grants, you often get commentary from people who, especially when they're rejecting your grant, they'll tell you exactly why in a very long list.
This is Jennifer Roan, who runs a research lab on UTIs that are difficult to treat. I wanted to find out more about this disconnect between science and perception, and why the research that is there keeps being left out of the healthcare system.
In this long list of rejections that I initially got when I was starting out, were statements like, you know, well, we don't need a new drug, or we already have antibiotics, or it's no big deal. It's just some, you know, small infection. It's not earth-shattering. And I think that there are increasing numbers of labs working on it, which is great. But still, compared with, if you just think about 400 million people a year get this disease, and there's probably about 20, 30, 40 laboratories in the world studying it, the disconnect between the number of patients and the number of scientists studying it is really eye-opening. And this fascinates me because I think it is sort of to do with the fact that it's been seen as a women's disease. Women's pain is traditionally dismissed. We have a higher threshold for people taking us seriously as patients. I think it's all tied into that. And I think it's changing, but we still need a lot more work and we need a lot more research funding to get to the bottom of it.
Now that there is more research, what's changed basically in the understanding of what a UTI is from your research?
Well, in the old days, people thought that UTI was a simple infection. And by that, I mean, you get some bacteria, they'd get up into the bladder, as they do. It's open to the environment. Anything can get up there. And it would maybe stick to the surface of the bladder and cause a bit of irritation. And that would translate as pain. And that's a UTI. That's what basically the sum total of what people thought about UTI. And it was only in more recent years that people realized it was much more complicated. So the bacteria, yes, they come in. Yes, they stick. But they also do really crazy things like invade the cells of the bladder and burrow into the wall of your bladder. And they hide out in these sorry, you look horrified. They go into these things that are known in the field as pods, which are basically like alien, and then they can burst open later and reinitiate your infection. So, for example, if you have a UTI, the bug might get up there, burrow into your bladder wall, multiply and make millions of copies of itself, and it's all quiescent, so it's hiding in there, and you don't know you have a UTI. Maybe you think you had a UTI and it's gone now, but deep inside your bladder, you still have these seeds or these reservoirs, and then later they can re-erupt, basically, and reinitiate a new round of infection. And this is something that nobody appreciated until about 2000, early 2000s. And that's just the tip of the iceberg of the interesting things we're discovering about UTI. That's just one example. There's all sorts of other ways that the bugs can subvert your immune system. They can hide from the immune system. And really, none of that was known about 20 years ago. And I think it's really fascinating how the field has moved on.
I was looking horrified, but I was also fascinated at the complexity of these bugs. It's clear that the deeply entrenched medical bias that surrounds women's health has shaped the way we understand UTIs.
I teach medical students every year, and I talk about UTI and I talk about some of these issues, and they have absolutely no idea. They never learned in their courses about chronic UTI. They never learned that diagnostic tests don't work very well. They never even learned that the bladder contains bacteria, that it's not sterile. And the fact that in the 21st century we can have medical schools at top universities not being taught these basic facts, things that have changed maybe over the last 20 years. I mean, you should be able to incorporate this into the curriculum, right?
If young doctors could be taught that for a large number of people, UTI is not just a one-off, and it's not a trivial, simple infection, it could make a huge difference. But where do you go if the doctors can't give you answers? With nowhere else to turn, women created online community groups, which have gathered huge followings and are still often the first places people will come across the term chronic UTI.
I posted this desperate post being like, I don't know what to do. Is anyone else just like crippled by constant UTIs? And there were hundreds of posts of these, thousands of posts. There are, I think,
tens of thousands of members now. So I'm just pouring through all of this information and reading all of these things, being like, holy shit, I haven't been making all of this up. I knew I wasn't making it up. It was a huge relief to just see myself in all of these women's stories and to have them say, there's language for this. But then you've got the other side of it, which is that the support group can be really overwhelming. You've got women being like, I've been in treatment for 6 years, I'm not cured. I've had this illness since I was 14 and now I'm in my 40s.
It is affirming to know that there's a lot of other people with the same issue, but it can be quite depressing. It can be quite depressing, and particularly if you see that someone is in a really bad way and will say, there's no way out of this, I'm going to end my life. You know, that's really upsetting for the rest of us, because we could all be in that position, couldn't we?
The thing that I can't even really bear to think about is the fact that if I'd been treated properly in the proper instance, if they'd listened to me when I said my symptoms hadn't gone away, I wouldn't have been in this situation. None of these women would have been in this situation. It's completely avoidable.
Does that make you angry?
It makes me want to scream and cry and shake people.
So I think it's made me more angry than anything else. The only way I can deal with this is to think that I'm actually doing something about it that might make a difference. That is the only way I can get through each day. But yeah, it's been really hard. Yeah. And as I say, I've got my daughter's wedding coming up, and I'll get there. I will get there, and I'll enjoy the day as best I can. But I'm living the best life I can, I think, at the moment.
The phrase chronic urinary tract infection has very recently been recognised by the NHS, which the sort of chronic UTI community is obviously seeing as a really big win.
How do you see it?
I see it as a... I don't know, it sounds really selfish, but, like, that doesn't help me. great, you've woken up and you've opened your eyes, but, like, I'm 4 years into treatment now. My savings have all gone down the bin. I can't drink a bottle of wine. I can't have, like, a sip of wine without crying myself to sleep. Like, woohoo, you've recognised the term. Obviously, it's great for the future, and obviously I want to minimise this happening to anyone else, which is why I'm so big on... Yeah, if anyone asks me about it, or if any woman is ever like, I have recurring UTIs, I'm like, you sit down and you listen to me, because you will not get the information from your doctor.
There are now a handful of charities and QT websites that help people manage these first stages. I've linked a few in the description of this episode. In episode 2 of QT, we'll be looking at the next stages of the journey. For those lucky enough to get there, that means treatment.
He said, my dear, you have a raging chronic infection. And I just looked at him and I thought, I knew I was ill.
Why is it so difficult to find?
How have we not come to this earlier? I couldn't believe I'd missed it.
And what have we been getting wrong?
Men get 7 to 10 days. Cats get 7 to 10 days. Why do we get 3 days' worth of antibiotics?
Huge thanks to Anna, Caroline and Lily for sharing their stories on this episode. And thanks to Dr. Raj Kasria and Professor Jennifer Roan for sharing their expertise. The art for QT was created by Edie Medley. And you can have a look at her comic It Burns, all about her own experience with QT. Her Instagram is also linked in this description. This podcast is powered by Transmission Roundhouse.